111 on WGN. Hello, everybody. And we're with you till 3 o'clock here this afternoon. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, across the way from me. How you doing today, Mike?
Great. What a beautiful day. I just want to start by patting myself on the back.
Yeah, please do. You want, I mean, this is really where we usually start the show.
But yeah,
go ahead.
We usually start or end it. But to get down here in like 55 minutes with a sandwich stop, on West Randolph, and then to get here on time, I mean, great work. I mean, I used a couple alleys.
Yep.
I used the U-turn.
Wow.
I used the kind of like saw the traffic and reversed. I mean, I did a lot of good moves.
Man, you really, you did it. Were your U-turns like on Randolph, which could be a confusing space to navigate? They've got the, what I like about Randolph is they have the main way. Now they've added a billion stop signs through West Town, which is smart. But then you kind of got the delivery alleyways you can really use if you're smart about it.
Yeah, you got to know your city a little bit. So yeah. I even did one off Wacker. I cut through the alley to get over to Franklin to avoid traffic. I felt good about my effort today.
Yeah. And you brought me a great sandwich. You brought Neil one too and yourself. And let's give JP Graziano's a shout out.
Very solid.
They didn't pay for it, but they deserve it. Jimmy
maybe,
is a great.
Maybe since we have such a huge listening base, they'll agree to buy our sandwiches for now until eternity.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good idea. I'll talk to Jimmy about that, see if we can do it. But no, I love JP Graziano's. Great family history and story there too. And they've really pivoted to meet the times on West Randolph. You got to let me know when you're going to move that mic, Mike.
Is it far? Is it close? Is it making noise?
No, you sound good, but when you move it, it's a jarring sound to the listener. So if you ever hear that again, listeners, that's Mike moving his microphone. Mike, you're a federal defense attorney. Do you mind going on this history journey with me as I give you a little bit about a really important law in our nation's history?
I think it's very cool. One thing you've kind of gone away with, unless I've missed it, when I first came on the show as a toddler a few years ago, mm-hmm. you used to do the
question of the day.
What happened?
So we do it on Your Money Matters on my other show
okay. Pretty
frequently. And I was originally actually going to do a question of the day for this, but I thought I'd just get right to it.
I think that's great. And I just want to tell you and warn the listeners. The listeners will probably be happy, but I'm going to remain silent the rest of the show because Karen Conti is having me on tomorrow.
Whoa.
So I don't want to waste any words today. So I'm just going to be quiet. You'll do most of the talking, which is how it goes anyways. Guests won't notice anything.
All right. Well, be quiet. Eat your sandwich. Don't move the microphone. I'm with Karen Conti. How about that? Okay, so the law that I'm going to celebrate, and we're going to do one a week leading up to the 4th of July, and there are so many momentous pieces of legislation through our history. Not all of them are bipartisan, not all of them are popular, so I'm going to focus on the ones that I think universally or nearly universally we can all still agree are great. And that limits it, Mike.
Okay. And so you are going to give us a clue?
No, I'm just going to give it to you.
Oh, come on. No, just give
us. Do you know what the one I'm going to do or no?
I have no idea. Can you give a clue? And then we have people text in, stuff like that.
I'll have you guess. It's from 1990. It's Bush 1 who signed this. And it wasn't a unanimous vote, but it was awfully close. I will say that it was bipartisan largely in part of much of the effort of Bob Dole, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time. And that is a key part of why this passed on through. And there's a reason why he is someone who championed this. Do you have any idea?
Do you want me to make a guess?
Yeah, go ahead.
It was the approval of funds and the authorization to create the Vietnam Memorial.
No, that's a great guess, but it is not that.
I know he'd be probably World War II, but maybe he was a military guy.
Nope. But he... if you remember from his presidential campaigns and then spoofs on SNL, he always was sort of joked at for an injury he had.
Correct.
And because of that, go ahead, Mike.
The Americans with Disabilities Act.
That is correct.
Wow.
It is one of the most significant civil rights laws in modern American history, signed into law in 1990 in July by George H.W. Bush. And we've talked about it on this show because Patrick brings it up fairly often because it really pertains to employment as well. But for much of American history, people with disabilities were excluded from schools, from jobs, transportation, public life even. Many buildings had stairs but no ramps. Buses couldn't accommodate wheelchairs at all. And employers could legally refuse to hire someone because of a disability until the year 1990. Now, there had been some movements through the 60s and 70s. Well, a lot of movements were underway. And the precursor to the ADA was actually an act in 1973 called the Rehabilitation Act. And it had one specific section in it that said that organizations that receive federal funding could not discriminate based with people with disabilities. That's often how these movements start, is a section of a bill and they tie federal funding to it. Congress doesn't like to step in federally on a lot of things. It defers often to the states, but the arm of, hey, if you're going to get federal funding, is one that they like to use here and there. But there was the first real movement on this was after that bill, there was something called the 504 sit-in. And this was in relation to Section 504. That's why they named it. It was in 1977, and disability activists occupied federal offices demanding the enforcement. The law had passed, but people felt that they weren't enforcing it. Do you remember anything about this? I don't think a lot of people know the of this.
No, because I was what, 10 or 12 at the time? So, yeah, but no knowledge of that one. That's pretty cool, though.
They sat in these San Francisco buildings, and it lasted about a month.
Wow.
They said, you are not doing this. The protest convinced the government to finally implement regulations. There was a lot of movement through the 80s, and then support really grew across party lines. And one of the most memorable moments came in March of 1990. So President Bush had been in office about a year and a couple months when dozens of activists abandoned their wheelchairs and mobility devices. And I think a lot of people remember when they literally crawled up the U.S. Capitol to show how inaccessible public spaces were.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. That's awesome.
I've seen videos of the news footage of it, and it is, what a powerful statement that was. It became known as the Capitol Crawl.
Wow.
And it helped build passage for the ADA. So I have a little news, Neil. You got that from July 26th, 1990. Jim Lehrer, let's go. Momentous occasion. Now, after its passage, courts often narrowed the focus of who qualified as disabled or not. So one aspect of this that I find really great is that they came together again during George Bush II's term, and two terms, and passed kind of a revised ADA that included mental health aspects and a sort of a bunch of other things that sort of widened, or I guess more specifically detailed, who was disabled or not. So both father and son, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, and a lot of other Republicans and Democrats coming together. And Mike, that just like, those are moments that give me hope that we can do the big things.
Yeah, that's cool. Do you think the second Bush was motivated, like in part to, you know, make the amendments because of his father?
I bet. Yeah. I mean, he's displayed loyalty to his father in other ways, Saddam Hussein and other things along those ways.
Yes.
That many people may not like, but here in this instance, I would imagine so. I think that he often looked to his father, who was a war hero. Maybe, I don't know how effective of a president was. He obviously lost re-election to Bill Clinton, but some could say, you know, really effective, especially in this sort of way. He had a lot of bipartisan legislation. He was a big advocate for NAFTA, which didn't get done until, of course, Bill Clinton came around. But I do think that there was a little loyalty for him to finish this up.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. I mean, at the time it was passed originally in 1990, I was still in law school. I would have had no idea that I would ever be litigating those claims, and I have, you know.
Oh,
so,
really? Yeah, ADA so, claims, yeah?
Yeah, so in my old life, probably prior to 2013, I worked for, you know, a decently large firm in Chicago that represented employers on a lot of cases. So we would have a lot of cases involving the ADA where we're representing the employer. But exclusively since 2013, I've had a number of those cases on behalf of employees. And it is interesting, like you would think, you know, I guess people would say, well, you know, companies are real sophisticated now. They wouldn't discriminate, but it happens all the time. And so even recently, we've gotten some cases where the situation has been, you know, you had a mental health issue or you took time off for a mental health issue. And all of a sudden, you know, you're persona non grata. All of a sudden, you're on a performance improvement plan or you're fired. And I think what a lot of people also don't realize is that, so you have the federal ADA, and then you have Illinois' counterpart under the Illinois Human Rights Act. So if you're representing an individual like I do and Patrick does, you know, you can choose to file your charge of discrimination with the EEOC federally, right, or with the Illinois Department of Human Rights. And then depending upon, you know, where you file, that means where you're going to go to court. So representing individuals, we want to end up in state court typically. So we would want to file those ADA-like type of charges before the Illinois Department of Human Rights and then end up in state court at the Daley Center someday. So,
interesting.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people don't know ADA has its state counterpart, and most states have a similar law to the AD under their own state law.
Makes sense to me. So, yeah, that's our celebration of America 250 today, the history of the ADA. And I don't know which one we're going to do next. There's a lot of ones that I think are important and huge, but have been chipped away at, and some people don't love as much anymore. And so I want to be careful to try and pick things I think we can all get behind, but I think the ADA falls under that category.
That's cool. Yeah, it's a good choice to start it. And I thought you were going to go way back in history, and I would have no clue how to answer. You know, I'm usually stumped on these questions where it's like, hey, what happened? You know, the trivia ones.
You did get it wrong first. So.
True.
But you got it the second guess. Tell you what, let's take a break. Then we're going to get to what you want to chat with Mike Leonard. More Let's Get Legal after this on WGN. 125 on WGN. John Hansen here. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Mike Leonard, our federal defense attorney who joins us pretty frequently. Last week we chatted, Mike, you, me, and Patrick, on the Memorial Day weekend. Of the big story of the week at the time was the Anti-Weaponization Fund, the $1.776 billion fund that would bar administration, or that would the administration could then transfer to people who made claims saying that they were weaponized against by the Department of Justice. It got a lot of bipartisan pushback. I mean, a lot of it. Some of it out in the open, a lot of it behind closed doors. I know that Acting Attorney General got an earful from Senate Republicans who were unhappy about it. And a lot of my friends who are conservatives, who are Trump supporters, even they were bristling at how seemingly brazen it seemed on its face. Well, as of right now, it's halted, right, Mike?
Yeah, so two interesting developments happened. One was an action filed in another federal district court to enjoin the creation of the commission that's going to issue the money and to stop any money from being issued, right?
Okay, so just so to, like, pause everything in its
tracks. Yeah, basically a lawsuit's filed, and they also asked for injunctive relief. So the court granted the temporary injunction. So the parties will have to brief it, present evidence, and then the court will decide whether the party who filed that action has a likelihood of succeeding on the merits of their case, and therefore the injunction could continue. But the other thing that happened that's sort of notable, and we kind of were making our predictions last time, in the case in which the IRS case was settled and the fund was created, if you remember, in that case, before the settlement happened, the federal court judge had said, hey, I want briefing on whether there's really oppositional interests here. Is the plaintiff really different than the defendant? Does the plaintiff really control the defendant?
Are these two opposing sides that want different things?
Yeah.
Or are you all the same people?
Yeah, because you had the president, who's a member of the executive branch, suing a department that's under the control of the executive branch.
Right.
So the district court in that case, before the settlement, had said, hey, I want briefing on whether we really have an adverse relationship in this case, or whether the interests are really the same, plaintiff versus defendant. And then, as you know, and some people said, to stop a ruling on that, the settlement agreement was reached. So in that court, now that court is requiring briefing on the issue of whether there was, quote, a fraud upon the court. Was the settlement agreement reached in a way to circumvent a ruling by the court? Which is kind of interesting, because things can happen. Cases can settle to avoid a ruling from the court. For example, there might be a, let's just take an average civil case. Let's take a PI case, personal injury case, in court. And the defendant might file what's called a motion for summary judgment, saying, hey, judge, we took all the depositions. Here's the evidence. Here's the testimony. Here's why we win before there's a trial. And so at that point, there's risk. You know, the case might get dismissed. The judge might rule in favor of the defendant. And the parties might choose to settle to avoid a ruling. There's nothing wrong with that. So you could argue that the same logic applies. What prohibits two parties who want to settle a case from settling to avoid a ruling? This is on a massively different scale. I get it.
Well, I think the judge was going to rule against them as saying you're not legitimately in this courtroom to begin with. And so if that's the case, then I could see why she might say, well, you came up with this settlement, but I was about to rule and will rule that you guys aren't opposing forces here, and this shouldn't even be in a court of law to begin with. Where a settlement that comes out of a fake, quote-unquote, case you brought to me should be tossed, and the settlement should go with it.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of arguments that, number one, it was sort of, and I talked about this last time you pushed back against me, a quote, frivolous lawsuit, because, you know, Trump was essentially suing, saying IRS, an IRS contractor had improperly released my tax returns. I'm entitled to $10 billion, okay? So on the one hand, perhaps he had standing to bring that case, because if his tax returns were leaked improperly, yes, there's an avenue for relief. Everyone thought the claim for damages was ridiculous and had no foundation. Like, you know, what's the basis of your damages for $10 million? You've suffered no damages, arguably. So there were people who said the case is legitimately brought, and there's others that said it wasn't legitimately brought because you had someone who controls the defendant suing the defendant.
I think it's legitimately brought if he's a private citizen. As the chief executive now suing your own department, that seems like something that, hey, let's pause this till you're out of office, and then you can sue and get damages. I thought that was the avenue in which they should have done.
Agreed. I think the case should have been stayed.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, eliminate the possibility that the plaintiff and his attorneys can control the defendant and their attorneys. Put the case on hold. Let him, you know, serve his time, come out of office. Because again, what you're seeking as a remedy is just monetary damages.
Yeah.
You get monetary damages now or later. It doesn't really matter.
It doesn't really matter, exactly. Okay, let's take a break here for the news. More with Mike Leonard. Get your questions and comments in, 312-981-7200. 135 on WGN. Hey, everyone. Happy Saturday afternoon. John Hanson here. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. So good to chat with you again. 312-981-7200. You can call in with your questions for Mike Leonard. Really, anything and everything. He'll do his best to answer what you got, whether it's a issue that you're having or you want to talk about some bigger legal stories of the day. So, Mike, you ready for our first call?
Let's do it, John. Can't wait.
Let's go to Jack down in Champaign. Love Champaign, Urbana. Go ahead, Jack. What's your question for Mike?
Hey, Mike, thank you for your expertise. In December of 24, I sold an aircraft. And I went into my bank with several $100 bills. The teller ran them through the machine, and she said, "I'm sorry, we're going to have to keep about 12 of these." And I said, "Well, can I just take a look at them so I can get the picture of each one?" She handed them back to me, and I said, "You know, I changed my mind. I talked to the bank manager. He said, hey, you've got two choices. You can leave now or you can give the money back." Well, the police came.
Whoa.
I was put in jail.
What?
For about 4 hours. I was fingerprinted and mugshotted, and the Secret Service came all the way from Chicago, and they called the bank manager and said, hey, this is all legal tender.
Wait, so they thought you had fake money, and so you were arrested?
Well, I was detained, but fingerprinted and mugshotted.
Huh.
And I wrote the bank. Now, this is a national bank, and I won't say the name, of
course. Thank you.
And I emailed them a long letter saying, hey, look, I bought a four-wheel drive truck and a home. I've been with this bank 30 years. And this is how you're going to treat me? I never received a boo back.
That's
from
crazy. Mike, you got questions or follow-ups? Or?
Wow. I'm sorry
that's
that happened to you.
Story.
And then that just kind of shows you why, when people like John Hanson say, why do you represent people accused of crimes? This is a perfect example. But, Jack, that's a horrible situation. I mean, it's crazy because, first of all, there was no probable cause to think you need to be detained, yet alone arrested and held.
Because you could have counterfeit money that someone, let's say it was counterfeit money. He just sold an aircraft to someone that they may have given him counterfeit money. You're just trying to deposit it in the bank and they're going to detain you?
Yeah, that's ridiculous. And the thing that the bank relies upon is they try to throw up their hands, Jack, and say, gee, it's not us. You know, it's law enforcement who detained you. It's not our fault. But obviously they played a role in this. Probably not a basis to sue them, but it's just a really unfortunate situation. The normal way of handling that would be if they wanted to, if they really took a keen interest in you, Jack, and let's say you had been someone who had been coming in there on a weekly basis for weeks with counterfeit bills, then they would want to question you, you know, and it would be a normal thing for someone like the Secret Service or FBI to come down and try to question you. But to detain you, print you, hold you in custody is just absurd, and I'm really sorry for you that the bank doesn't have a wherewithal to admit that they were wrong and they contributed to the situation.
Jack, you're not still their customer, are you?
Well, I'm soon to not be.
Good. Get out of there. Get into someone else. There's a lot of other banks that'll do good work, and I know a few of them in Champaign that do good stuff. I'm curious, Mike, when do they fingerprint you? I thought you had to be arrested to get fingerprinted.
I mean, yeah, typically he would never be printed without being arrested. So did they ever tell you that you're under arrest at any time?
No, absolutely not.
Did they cuff you?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, I mean, so but basically you were under arrest. You were detained. You weren't free to leave. And so they were waiting for the feds to come down because then they were going to say, yeah, charge him with X, Y, or Z. And, of course, they were completely wrong. I mean, you would have recourse. I mean, not that you want to do it in a civil lawsuit against those local law enforcement people. But the reality is, in terms of those cases having a monetary value, it really is dependent upon being in custody for a significant period of time. I know 4 hours probably felt like forever. But in terms of case having a value before a jury, you want to be in custody for much longer and sometimes have injuries, et cetera, et cetera. Not to diminish what happened, but what a crazy situation, Jack.
Yeah. Hey, at least you
got... Well, now, I lost a full day of work, and I was, fingerprinted and cuffed and put in a jail cell. Do I have any... is any attorney going to want to take this against the bank?
Maybe. I mean, I would talk to someone locally who represents plaintiffs in civil rights, police misconduct cases in the Champaign area. The problem is, as I alluded to before, when you're evaluating one of those cases and whether you want to take the case on, typically you're going to want a case, just from a lawyer perspective, where the person's detained longer, the case goes on, you are improperly charged, all that sort of thing.
Seems unfair, but it's the reality of what a jury's going to award you and then the cost of the lawyer.
It'll probably get hard for someone to do that. But what you can always do is, you can have a good attorney down there who might want to write a demand letter to the law enforcement, to local level who are involved in threatening the suit, and that may yield you recovery, it may not. But, yeah, what just a overall ridiculous situation. And of course, that causes you emotional distress, even though we always think that term's used too much, but that's a perfect example of a situation like that.
Jack, did you reach out to local media down there, WCIA or someone down there?
No, it actually happened in the Munster area.
Oh, okay. In Indiana.
But no, I did not reach out to anybody.
Yeah.
But I have a friend who is a bank president. She was at one time, and she said, "Oh my gosh, you need to go get a lawyer."
You could consider doing that. Someone locally near you, and at least chat with someone locally, see if they'll take the case. I also just think, you should be getting apologies from the police and from the bank, and sometimes a little media pressure on them will make them at least recognize that they did something wrong and issue an apology. And to someone out there wondering, well, why would you go through that much effort? And that's up to you, Jack. For me, it's just like the satisfaction of knowing that I want someone to tell me what they did was wrong. And sometimes the best way to do that is get a local TV station to call them and push it along a little bit, Jack.
Yeah, and the reality is, if it was fresh, if this happened yesterday and you're talking to media, they'd be all over it. They'd love the story. Probably now, not so much. But, yeah, I mean, you always have recourse. You always have a remedy. It's just that, to file the lawsuit and go through that, you have to convince an attorney that because you can only get monetary damage, it's going to be worth everyone's time to do it. But clearly, the bank was in the wrong, local law enforcement was wrong, and good to hear that Secret Service came to the rescue and did the right thing here.
Jack, we appreciate your phone call, okay?
Okay, and thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks. Most stories where you start with saying, I sold an aircraft. And a lot more fun than that.
That's pretty cool. I like the opening.
I like that part.
We should have asked him more questions about selling the aircraft. But the part that reminded me about the money is, when you have change from the sandwiches and you won't give it back to me, even though I gave you the money to buy the sandwiches, that I can relate to Jack 100%. I might have a claim against WGN for emotional distress.
Okay, very good. Yeah, very good. Well, we'll try and make that good. 312-981-7200. You and I chatted about, and it had to have been when I was in for John Williams. You popped on so many of our shows before in the past, I can't keep them straight. But I believe you came on when I was hosting for John, and we talked about the Broadview. Yes, it was last Friday. The quote-unquote Broadview 6 that had then been the Broadview 4, who had all their charges dropped once it became very apparent from the judge's perspective that they looked at a unredacted part of the grand jury where the lawyers for the district, the state, the attorneys, the federal attorneys had clearly wronged And it was so bad to the case that then the U.S. attorney stepped in and said, we're dropping all charges. First of all, I told that story terribly, so you probably do a better job at it. Any follow-up here a week later on that one?
Yeah, there's been a lot of backlash because of that. So, you know, in general, what happened was, you know, normally in a federal criminal case, just like a state criminal case, you're not entitled to get the grand jury transcripts, the complete grand jury transcripts. So what we normally get, for example, in a federal criminal case, we'll get grand jury testimony of people who are going to testify at trial, okay? Because they've testified under oath, and they may testify differently at trial, so you can use the grand jury testimony to impeach them. But as a general rule, there's this big emphasis on grand jury secrecy, the fact that they have to be autonomous, that we shouldn't be looking over their shoulders and into their deliberative processes, and they should be anonymous, right? So that's why here's what we're up against is we don't get the full transcripts, okay? So
I think that's a silly rule.
So we don't get – you could keep the names of the people anonymous. There's no problem. But we'd get to see what did the prosecutor say to the grand jury that led to the indictment? What questions were asked? What responses were given by the prosecutors? What generalities were said by the prosecutors? Because what happened in the case we're talking about, the Broadview 6, it turned out that in a one in a million move, the judge allowed the transcripts to be unsealed, and she reviewed them, first redacted, meaning stuff was blacked out, and then later unredacted. And it showed misconduct by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And some of the things we talked about, John, were vouching, meaning when a prosecutor's telling grand jurors things like, hey, you know, there might be more evidence, or, you know, this is a really strong case, or you should indict, you know, things like that when you're interjecting your personal feelings and statements. And there are other, you know, sort of grievous errors that never occur, but we never find out about them because we never see these transcripts. And then the big revelation over the last week, which has led to a lot of talk, is that there's been information given to the public and to the people involved in that case that the U.S. attorney, the top prosecutor, had some contact with the grand jurors. He and his office are making it seem like he was just greeting them, just sharing generalities with them. But there's no reason he should be talking to them. So what's happened in the last few days is this push that he should be fired. I'm not taking any position on that, but that's been the latest story. Like, he should be removed now. So the case has had massive implications. But the common sense thing to me is, in every case, why wouldn't defense counsel be able to see what did the prosecutor say to the grand jury? What questions did they ask back? What did the prosecutor say about the law and the facts? Because we're in the dark. We're under this idea that, oh, prosecutors never make mistakes, intentionally or unintentionally, so we shouldn't be able to see that stuff. Why not?
That makes no sense.
Makes the system more fair to see them.
Exactly. And he did announce that he was going to have sweeping reforms to internal grand jury practices and disclosures. But there's other cases now in Chicago, including Law Club Chicago has been on top of the Loretto Hospital executives and their scandals involving COVID tests. And the federal prosecutors are out of this district. And now they're saying they should get their case tossed, or we should be able to see what they said to grand juries. I mean, this has sweeping implications.
Yeah. So, for instance, in the Broadview 6 case, one of the prosecutors who's come under the most fire, she was involved in other grand jury cases for cases that are pending right now, right?
Right.
And so there's already been disclosures in some of that individual's other cases that there might be issues. Okay.
Yeah.
So clearly that office is going to have to look at every grand jury and see what she said and what she did. That's going to be obvious. But to me, broadly speaking, you're going to have to look at all of those grand jury transcripts going back for a number of years to see what has been happening in those grand juries.
Absolutely. All right, we got to take a break. We're going to try and get to both Lisa and Mark afterwards with Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney on WGN. All right, 720 WGN, John Hansen here. It's almost said Your Money Matters. No, it's Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Mike, we got a couple calls we're going to try and get to, okay?
Well, let's do it, John.
So Lisa and Mark, I apologize. I'm going to have you give me the Cliff Notes version of your story. Lisa, out of Forest Park, you go first. Lisa, hello.
Hi, thank you guys for taking my call. I was in an accident, and I was the victim in the accident, and I do have a medical bill that they're still kind of pushing back on me about. The medical bill is $5,400.
Okay.
They're trying to give me, they said, encloses a release info of all claims for $3,500. And as part of the settlement, they'll pay any reasonable and necessary medical expenses related to the accident up to $10,000.
Hmm.
But I thought it was just odd because I even told the girl, I said, all I want you to do is pay my medical bill. I'm not asking for anything else. But, and then she wanted me to, like, go over the papers with her on the phone so I can sign while I was on the phone with her.
Oh, no, no, no.
It's all kind of suspicious.
Mike, yeah, that is, well, it's a common tactic, and it is suspicious. So have you already signed a settlement agreement?
No, I didn't. I told her, listen, I'm going to look at it this weekend.
Good. I would never sign that. First of all, I'm not trying to advocate for lawyers because I don't do really much personal injury law myself. However, I do know enough about it that it's usually a bad decision to ever sign any kind of settlement agreement, including one for personal injuries, without talking to a lawyer. But even if you don't do that, do not sign one unless it's specifically clear they are going to pay that bill and any others. Otherwise, I would not do it. But, you know, you could talk to a qualified personal injury lawyer. But, you know, their goal is to try to get you to settle as low as possible and as quickly as possible, right? And so when there's these open-ended provisions that don't make clear what they're going to pay for, I would be very suspicious about that and very circumspect about signing any of that kind of agreement. So if you can't talk to an attorney, make sure that it's specifically spelled out what they're paying for, what they're not. And the reason also why they want to do this quickly is there might be some permanency to your injuries or there might be some other effects, and they want to settle and close you out now before that's ever discovered. So I would be real cautious and real careful about signing anything that doesn't specifically pay for everything that you're entitled to get. And sometimes the only way to know that is talk to a personal injury attorney. However, of course, there's a fee involved, right?
Yeah. Lisa, I do have one for you if you want to hang on the line. I can give it to Neil. Joe Vito came on. He's from Vito and Dolemire a couple of weeks ago. Seems like a really good guy and great customer service over there. They take your calls. I can give you his number if you stay on the line. Okay, Lisa?
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I love that our spidey senses were up,
though. And one thing, too, that we didn't touch upon is, like, they're just offering the lowest lowball offer they can give you, right? So, you know, you say, well, why should I hire an attorney? Because you're probably going to get a lot more money.
Yeah, exactly. You know? All right, let's go to Mark out of Cary. Hi, Mark. We got about 3 minutes left, so you'll have to go pretty quick here. I'm sorry.
You bet. Hi, gentlemen. Cliff note of the story is I was hit by a drunk driver, and I was the third party in it. So they hit someone, and they hit me. And unfortunately, I had a child in the car, a newborn, and nothing happened.
Oh, thank God.
Which was great. Very blessed on that end of it. But they quickly, within 2 days, the insurance company offered me back pay, as in work, and some of the stuff, items.
We're losing you a little bit there, Joe. Or Mark, make sure your mouth's right on that receiver. Give us a little more.
Sure, sure. Like I said, I was the third party, and they offered a settlement really quick in the first 2 days after the accident. And I'm just trying to find out what...
Have you signed anything yet, Mark?
Oh, no, sure not.
Good. Oh. Yeah, just very similar to the last caller in the sense that, again, their goal, the insurance company, is to get you on the horn, have you sign a settlement, releasing all your rights for the lowest possible amount of money they can pay you, right? So, again, I know that I'm not here to advocate about hiring attorneys, but it's usually a major mistake not to talk to counsel before signing any settlement agreement whatsoever and, you know, get a better sense of what you might be entitled to recover in that case, because the offsetting cost of the attorney, you know, versus getting a much larger recovery or making sure that your rights are protected is much more important to me than to sign something quickly, because that's exactly what they're trying to do. Sign it quick, release all your claims, give you a lowball amount of money.
All right, I got a little bit more time. I got a text question for you. 630. I've never needed to use a bail bond company. How does that work? Are they regulated? What should I be aware of if they were asked to help me or a friend?
So bail bond companies usually don't exist anymore in Illinois because cash bail has been eliminated. So used to be in Illinois, you know, you'd get a bond set, you'd have to come up with a percentage of that to get out of the jail. And so you would have a company that might step in and provide that money at a cost to you. So in Illinois, that system doesn't exist. So I don't know if you're calling from Indiana or Wisconsin or somewhere else, but basically it's a third party who's posting your bail, your bond, right, at a fee to you, and they're taking the risk that you're going to appear in court. You know, if you flee, they're going to try to take steps to get you because they don't want to forfeit that bond that they posted for you.
Okay. So they were at least legit companies.
Oh, they're legit companies, and they are regulated by the state. If it's Illinois, I'd be very careful because Illinois, there shouldn't be any cash bonds.
Cash bail, yeah.
Yeah, so it shouldn't matter. But so I would take a look at that. If you want to give us a call, too, you can this week.
Yeah, who should be calling you, generally speaking, Mike Leonard?
Well, we represent individuals who are charged with crimes or being investigated for possible commission of crimes at the state and federal level. We also represent college and university and students who are accused of any form of misconduct, including academic or non-academic misconduct. And we also represent whistleblowers, John.
Yeah, you do a lot of great stuff. Leonard Trial Lawyers, and what's the phone number, Mike, before you take your sip of Diet Dr. Pepper?
312-380-6559, LeonardTrialLawyers.com.
And the 630 followed up that they're in Florida. And,
oh, that's why. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
They still have cash mail.
So don't call me because
sure.
I don't know anything about Florida law. I'm glad you're getting our show down there in Florida.
Oh, we have a lot of snowbirds that became permanent Florida listeners. We got a whole cadre of Florida listeners.
Can we have an event in Florida where you pay for it and we go fly down and do live from like a tiki bar on the beach?